I'm Frances Callier.
And I'm Angela V. Shelton.
And we're Frangela.
You know what you need in your life? The Final Word Podcast.
Yes, you do.
That's right. It is the final word on all things political and pop cultural.
Where we make real news real funny.
Where we inspire you so you can hashtag resist.
Subscribe and get a new episode of the Final Word Podcast each week. It's the news we think you need to hear.
That's right. We think you need to hear it. Okay.
Yeah, it's what we say so.
That's right. And because all we do is give, every Thursday you can listen to our hysterical podcast, Idiot of the Week.
We round up the stupid because you know what? Somebody has to.
Okay. All we do is give.
MSW Media.
Season 4 of How We Win is here.
For the past 4 years, we've been making history in critical elections all over the country. And last year, we made history again by expanding our majority in the Senate, beating election-denying Republicans in crucial state House races, and fighting back a non-existent red wave.
But the MAGA Republicans who plotted and pardoned the attempted overthrow of our government now control the House, thanks to gerrymandered maps and repressive anti-voter laws. And the chaotic spectacle we've already seen shows us just how far they will go to seize power, dismantle our government, and take away our freedoms.
So, the official podcast of The Persistence is back with Season 4. There's so much more important work ahead of us to fight for equity, justice, and our very democracy itself. We'll take you behind the lines and inside the rooms where it happens with strategy and inspiration from progressive changemakers all over the country.
And we'll dig deep into the weekly news that matters most and what you can do about it with messaging and communications expert, co-founder of Way to Win, and our new co-host, Jennifer Fernandez Ancona.
So join Steve and I every Wednesday for your weekly dose of inspiration, action, and hope.
I'm Steve Pearson.
And I'm Jennifer Fernandez Ancona.
And this is How We Win.
The rule of law is not just some lawyer's turn of phrase. It is the very foundation of our democracy. The essence of the rule of law is that like cases are treated alike. That there not be one rule for Democrats and another for Republicans, one rule for the powerful, another for the powerless, one rule for the rich and another for the poor, or different rules depending upon one's race or ethnicity. To serve as Attorney General at this critical time is a calling I am honored and eager to answer.
So yeah, now it's clean up on aisle 45 time. And for a long while yet, it is going to be clean up on aisle 45.
Hello and welcome to episode 39, I think, of Clean Up on Aisle 45. It's Wednesday, October 13th. I'm your co-host, Allison Gill, and with me from the middle of the Atlantic Ocean is my co-host, Andrew Torres.
Woo! Allison, I have missed you so much. Although I listened to the last two episodes, Renato Mariotti, Morgan Stringer, I kind of feel like maybe the show got a little better while I was away. I don't know.
Yeah, while you were kissing mermaids and riding the El Nino and walking the sands with the crustaceans, I was here with Mo Stringer and Renato. You know, they're excellent, but there is no substitute for my dungeon basement lawyer. And I am so glad to talk to you again. But we have a great show today. I'm excited to do this with you. This is a really good one. I'm proud of it. We're following up on major developments and two big stories we've covered here a lot in depth on this show and in both of our other shows. First, you're going to talk about the legal maneuverings and rulings concerning the Department of Justice's lawsuit and you know, a motion to enjoin for SB 8.
Yep, yep. And then you are going to expose the deep state conspiracy. The globalists, they're circling their wagons to protect indicted fraudy McFraud pants Michael Sussman, who's part of the secret cabal that, you know, like...
Andrew?
Yes, yes.
We did not become InfoWars or a subsidiary thereof while you were on vacation, just so you know.
We didn't? I always thought that I was like the thin, I don't know, white line that held us back from cashing in on that right-wing gravy train.
We would have so much more money, Andrew.
Oh, God, so much more money, yeah.
You're the one. I remember when I turned down that Bloomberg money. Man, I'm still not in Turks and Caicos because of that, but... You're the one who keeps authorizing us to run those 1-800 cash for your bones commercials that I have to cancel.
Oh, yeah, fair.
But what really helps us from cashing in on the right-wing gravy train is our amazing patrons who support us over at patreon.com/aisle45pod for as little as a dollar an episode.
I love our patrons who support us over at patreon.com/aisle45pod for as little as a dollar an episode. And this week, that means I love Lisa, Amanda Loomis, Stacey Gray, and this is a great name. This is not the greatest voting system in the world. No, this is just a plurality.
You gotta believe me. And since it's that time again, I get to thank our Hall of Fame patrons. Stephen Mackinnon, Christopher Dalpy. Do I have that right?
I think so.
Dude, Jessica Oadbeer.
She's dreamy. Oh, yeah.
Yes, our pink Okami, she calls herself. And I also want to thank Lance Buckley, Crimer, no criming. And I gave a picture of Andrew to my orthodontist so I could get him on a retainer.
That is an excellent pun. Doesn't work, but excellent pun.
David in Brooklyn, also known as... No, he's not AKA. He's just David in Brooklyn. But then we have our patrons who have no vowels in their name. Fivicher Stafivi. Dr. Huffar is what I'm going to call Huffar. Edit Wikipedia. Yes, you can contribute to the world's foremost source of free knowledge and maybe get sued by a quack. Metacon 7 enjoys their 4 minutes and 59 seconds of legally allowed evil. Charles Jones, Chris Waltrip, January 20 baby, Patty B. Mitchell, and our all-time great Chris Simpson.
Woohoo, Chris Simpson. Thank you all so much for being our Hall of Famers. We will never sell out to InfoWars as long as you know, continue to give us money. So, and now on to the A block.
Yeah, I don't feel like getting arrested. A block today. Obviously, one of the stories we've been covering at great length is Texas's SB8, the nation's most restrictive anti-abortion law that does two things, right? First, it takes an imaginary thing called a fetal heartbeat that occurs preposterously early during a fetus's development. And it's mostly just the sounds the machine makes, by the way,
yeah,
at around 6 weeks after conception, and bans all abortions after that date, which is blatantly unconstitutional. And second, in a successful effort to provide a smokescreen for the Supreme Court to not notice that first thing, SB8 also delegates all of the enforcement of the abortion ban to private vigilantes to bring civil lawsuits. And that part of the bill also has a bunch of unconstitutional stuff in it, like ex post facto bans on certain affirmative defenses, right?
Yeah. And inexplicably, despite the fact that being double unconstitutional should have made it twice as easy for the Supreme Court to enjoin this law, our right-wing activist Supreme Court did nothing instead. Well, actually, they did two nothings, right? The first nothing they did was refusing to rule at all on the whole Women's Health Center's emergency request for injunctive relief before SB8 went into effect on September 1st. So it just went into effect as if no one had challenged it. And I want to emphasize this. As a lawyer, this is something the Supreme Court never, ever does, right? They don't just like space out on the date and let stuff happen. Like, this is their job, and they just let it go into effect.
Yeah, it's almost like the shadow docket. I think Steve Vladeck, our friend, coined that term, and he's coming out with a book about the shadow docket soon. Had you just sold it? I can't wait to read that. And then, after a full day of doing nothing, which I usually appreciate and applaud, but not in this case. The court finally issued an unsigned opinion in Whole Woman's Health v. Jackson about 5 minutes before midnight, so they could technically date it September 1st. And that unsigned opinion also did nothing. They sort of put it down in writing, if you remember. More specifically, it refused to grant any kind of injunctive relief to a blatantly unconstitutional law. And if you read the opinion, this is why we criticize the right-wing activist court as sneaking through massive public policy shifts on that shadow docket that I just mentioned, because the opinion doesn't address the merits of the abortion rights bill at all. And frankly, that ruling on Whole Women's Health that came down at the last second makes me worry about the final decision on injunctive relief for this bill that will eventually be decided.
We're going to get there. But you are correct, right? So in that case, the unsigned right-wing majority opinion, I think it was probably written by Alito, by the way, but that's just beans, right? We don't know who wrote it. It's not in a sparkly unicorn trapper keeper, so probably not Amy Coney Barrett, but the merits, so to speak, concede that Whole Women's Health, quote, raised serious questions regarding the constitutionality of the Texas law at issue, right? That's, and again, that's as explicit as you will ever get. Yeah.
I guess, Andrew, that means you and I are qualified to sit on the Supreme Court because we knew that.
Yeah. But then it goes on to say that the application, quote, also presents complex and novel antecedent procedural questions, right? That's the vigilante stuff smokescreen that you were referring to, about which the court just isn't sure whether they've carried their burden. And then there's a bunch of speculation about whether the law will really get enforced, right? And this was as of September 1st.
Yeah, and that's what paved the way for Attorney General Merrick Garland to file that lawsuit, really brilliant lawsuit, in federal court in Texas that we covered in depth on this show. And that lawsuit not only challenged SB 8 on the merits, but also moved for injunctive relief because, well, there was a separate motion for injunctive relief, because we actually have real-world evidence that SB 8 will indeed be enforced. The real vigilantes will bring lawsuits. We have real-world evidence now. And more importantly, that the threat of those lawsuits had its intended effect, which was to effectively shut down every abortion provider in Texas and drive women and pregnant people across the border into neighboring states. We covered that extensively on the Daily Beans about, you know, fivefold, tenfold impact on interstate commerce.
Yeah. And we broke down that complaint here on this show as well. It is a knockdown, no-brainer, right? Until the Supreme Court just changes the rules regarding abortion, which it is 100% going to do when it rules in probably May or June of 2022 on the Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Center case, right? That's the Alabama abortion ban that occurs, that kicks in at 16 weeks, right?
You gotta put the Margaret Atwood horse before the cart here, right?
Yeah, that is exactly right. They have not yet heard oral argument in that case. Oral argument is scheduled for December 1, right? So right now, what we have is a race against the clock, right? And that really matters in two key ways, right? First, I feel a little didactic for saying this, right? Like, it matters for people who get pregnant in Texas, right? And also, as you well pointed out in your last answer, like, it matters for people who get pregnant in states that border Texas, right? Who are finding their clinics swamped with out-of-staters, and it is
yeah, and it's not like Oklahoma and Louisiana have thousands of abortion clinics, right? I think Oklahoma has four.
Right. Yeah, Texas does not border California and New York. Yeah, that's a really good point. So, I don't want this to sound unnecessarily quaint, but like, those people are supposed to have constitutional rights as of today. I get that Amy Coney Barrett and Sam Alito and Clarence Thomas and the rest do not think that they do. But as of today, what's written down in our case books, right? What is the law from Planned Parenthood versus Casey, which radically restricted the ruling in Roe v. Wade, but nevertheless purported to, quote, uphold the central holding of Roe v. Wade, is that if you are pregnant and it is pre-viability, the state has no right to ban abortions or to impose an undue burden on your right to procure an abortion in those cases. That's what this bill does, right? So depriving them of a year's worth of their constitutional rights is generally what we lawyers call an irreparable harm, right? That's the first harm. The second way in which this race to the clock matters is that if SB 8 is allowed to operate for a year, half a year, right? 6 to 8 months before the Supreme Court issues that opinion in Dobbs, right? This court, we know what they're trying to do, right? 100% they will say, like, oh, come on, it's not such a big deal if we overturn Roe v. Wade and Planned Parenthood versus Casey, because after all, we've let Texas essentially ban abortion for half a year, and, you know, that state doesn't seem to be perpetually on fire yet, right? Like, they will use the application of this law as proof that everything's fine and it's no big deal. So, Allison, as you pointed out, like, that's why, and I think you're right, that it was our buddy Steve Vladek who coined the term the shadow docket. Like, that's why the shadow docket is so pernicious. It is the proverbial camel's nose under the tent.
Yeah, and I mean, and that was part of, you know, what I don't understand is how they'll be able to say, no biggie, it's been fine. Because if I were DOJ, I would file a thing like, it's not fine. You're violating the 14th Amendment. We have federal agencies that are being, you know, and it's not just, you know, every citizen should have access to their constitutional rights. But, you know, here are our specific little beefs. So, and this is what the DOJ did when they moved for injunctive relief. Now that SB 8 is in force. Last week, U.S. District Court Judge Robert Pittman of the Western District of Texas granted the preliminary injunction, ruling that SB 8 violates fundamental constitutional rights, and the United States has both standing to sue for injunctive relief. And the standing was great. It was just so well argued.
Oh, yeah.
to protect its citizens and a cause of action under general equitable principles. And that seems to make sense, right? You can't immunize an unconstitutional law just by turning enforcement over to vigilantes.
Yeah, no, that is exactly right. And the state of Texas, as you point out, the standing argument, the state of Texas made this very, very stupid argument in front of Judge Pittman that basically got them laughed out of the opinion, right? It said, hey, you know, we don't even know how you could enforce this, right? Are you going to enjoin every single person in the state of Texas? And shocker, Judge Pittman was like, this is a very stupid argument. He said, no, we do this kind of thing all the time. Here's all we have to do. All we have to do is enjoin the state courts in Texas from, and here I'm reading from the court's order, accepting or docketing, maintaining, hearing, resolving, awarding damages in, enforcing judgments in, enforcing any administrative penalties in, and administering any lawsuit brought pursuant to Texas Health and Safety Code sections 171.201 to 212. That's the statutory citation for SB 8. And then it adds, and I love this because this is how lawyers talk, for clarity, this court preliminarily enjoins state court judges and state court clerks who have the power to enforce or administer SB 8.
Yeah, so if the end run was to let vigilantes just file lawsuits, the way to block that end run is to stop those who are definitely state actors, right? The judges, yep, the clerks, court administrators, employees, from letting those who would want to reap the benefits of vigilante justice file those lawsuits. It stops them. That seems pretty straightforward to me. And like you said, we do this all the time. But then our joy, yep, was rather short-lived, thanks to the excruciatingly conservative Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals.
Yeah. And so we're recording this Monday night. This is just a procedural issue for now. Here's what happened. Okay. The second that Judge Pittman entered the injunction, Texas appealed that injunction up to the Fifth Circuit. And now the burdens flip, right? So what the Fifth Circuit did, in one sense, was perfectly normal, right? It administratively entered a stay of enforcement of the lower court order, which enjoined SB-8, pending expedited briefing. Now, that part is, if we were not talking about the Fifth Circuit, perfectly straightforward, right? Even if it's infuriating, right? When a lower court orders injunctive relief that's going to change the status quo, typically an appellate court will say, all right, well, before we do that, we're going to pause that order and stay the injunction long enough for the parties to brief their appeal. And the reason to do that is so that you don't moot the appeal, right? So that the issue is still live and preserved for the Fifth Circuit to render their judgment. Yeah.
Well, yeah, but when the pause, the totally normal administrative pause, causes irreparable harm and violates constitutional rights, I'm like, what the...
Well, that goes back to the Supreme Court. Yeah, exactly right. Right.
Yeah.
It is the status quo should not be SB-8 running. And we have our Supreme Court to thanks for that.
Yeah. And this administrative stay runs out Wednesday morning, today, when this show drops, of course. So here's your guide to understanding what the newspaper headlines mean. And just remember, we live in the opposite land. Okay. So... here's what you could be seeing today. The lower court enjoined SB-8 from going into effect. So now the question is, does the Fifth Circuit let that judgment take effect while the parties litigate the merits or not? If not, the Fifth Circuit will stay the judgment and keep the status quo, which means SB-8 is in effect while the parties litigate the merits. So a stay would be bad. That would stay the lower court's injunction because, you know, this was a temporary thing while they read up on it. Because, you know, the Fifth Circuit, big readers. And today, Wednesday, when this show drops, we're 2 days out from that now. They are going to decide whether or not this is going to be a stay pending the entirety of the litigation. Is that correct? Do I have that?
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. So, and there's one more wrinkle, right? Which is, this is only temporary because whichever side loses at the Fifth Circuit will immediately appeal for relief to the Supreme Court. And once again, that places us squarely right back on the shadow docket, where the Supreme Court will issue a bunch of unsigned opinions that have massive consequences while Sam Alito, you know, pretends that they're just calling balls and strikes on, you know, esoteric matters of procedure. And here's how you cut through that nonsense, right? If the Fifth Circuit stays the lower court's injunction and SB-8 goes into effect, goes back into effect, it has already been operating for a month, the DOJ will petition the Supreme Court for relief to block that stay, but there's basically no chance that the Supreme Court grants that relief because it will be super easy. Again, shadow docket, the Supreme Court can just issue a one-sentence per curiam opinion that says, the judgment of the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals is affirmed with no analysis, citing no cases, not Planned Parenthood versus Casey, not Roe v. Wade, not even any administrative law cases. They can just say, yep, Fifth Circuit is fine.
And I have a question for you. Vladek had said that the motion to enjoin by the DOJ was brilliantly written in that it was a motion to enjoin and not a restraining order. And that actually would force the Supreme Court to hear it on the merits. It couldn't be shadow docketed, but we're not talking about that yet. Is that correct?
Correct. Yeah. We are talking about the preliminary injunction.
We're on the stay.
Yeah. Exactly.
The stay only.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then on the contrary wise, what if it's the reverse? The Fifth Circuit has notoriously been anti-abortion. They teed up both Hellerstedt. They're bad. They're bad.
Right.
But what if the Fifth Circuit, contrary to our expectations, actually applies the law and declines to stay the lower court's injunction, as Neil Katyal has predicted. Neil Katyal has actually said, you would basically have to say the Department of Justice has no standing to argue on behalf of constitutional rights. That would have to be your conclusion. But, you know, obviously we'll see what happened. But then today, on Wednesday, but then you'll have the state of Texas petitioning the Supreme Court for a last-ditch relief. Is there any hope then? Because then we're back to shadow docket time, right?
Right. And there my answer is a pretty pessimistic maybe, right? Like, look, if this court actually gave a damn about the law, you'd say yes. If, and God help me for saying this, if Antonin Scalia were still alive, you'd say yes, right? You'd have people who cared about their view of jurisprudence and applying the law more than they cared about the outcome, right? But here's the breakdown, right? Of how the court aligns. We have four justices who have clearly signaled that they intend to apply the law. Those were the four justices who wrote in dissent in Whole Women's Health versus Jackson, right? Mm-hmm. It's Breyer, Sotomayor, Kagan, and Chief Justice Roberts, right? On the other side, you have three justices who do not care what the law is when it comes to, you know, what they think of as protecting unborn babies, right? That's Alito, Thomas, and Amy Coney Barrett. And then...
Oh, no. Are you saying it all boils down?
I'm saying, and again...
Is Gorsuch this is the not, swing vote here?
Yeah, we are not both sidesing this, right? Like, this is one millionth of an inch to the left of Amy Coney Barrett and Clarence Thomas, right? Like, this is not, you know, the fulcrum of... This is a very, very hard right group of Kavanaugh and Gorsuch who were handpicked by the Federalist Society to overturn Roe and Casey, right? That's why they were selected. I know one of the people who helped pick Kavanaugh, one of his former clerks, when he went on Fox News, this is a guy who debated, Justin Walker, who's now a judge on the DC Circuit, God help us all, went on Fox News, and his repeated catchphrase was that Justice Kavanaugh, as a Supreme Court justice, quote, will not go wobbly, end of quote. And when I brought that quote up in our debate, he said, well, you know, I mean on conservative principles or whatever. What that meant to the Fox News viewing audience was he is a vote for overturning Casey and Roe v. Wade. So will they join some transparently stupid opinion on bizarre technical grounds to overturn the Fifth Circuit? I mean, they joined the nonsense majority opinion in Jackson, so that's kind of where I would put my chips in, right? So, but that is indeed, as you point out, what the next 8 months of reproductive freedom in Texas would come down to, and that is, can you shame one of Kavanaugh or Gorsuch?
It would be easier if we investigated those 4,500 tips that came into the FBI, probably.
Yeah, that'd be nice.
That's disappointing.
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah, and I do know that per FBI memo 2012, they couldn't investigate those. They had to hand them over to the White House. I know, before you send your emails. Hey, anybody who needs help in Texas, you know, I'm over here in Southern California, let me know. Arizona's pretty purple. Yeah. Anyway, we will see. We'll see what happens today, which is 2 days from now. Time travel is interesting. And of course, we'll go over it next week for you,
yep,
whatever the decision absolutely is here. All right, we have more cleanup stuff to get to, but we have to take a quick break. Everybody stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hey everybody, it's Allison Gill, and today's episode of Cleanup on L45 is brought to you by Policy Genius. What is scarier than getting a box of raisins while trick-or-treating? Paying too much for your home and auto insurance. That is what is scarier than raisins in your pumpkin bucket. And I have to tell you, recently I dumped USAA because they advertise all the time on Tucker Carlson, and the way I found my new company and my new rate was through Policy Genius. You can avoid all of the hassle. They make it fast and easy to compare home and auto policies all in one spot. And they can help you find coverage similar or exact to what you have now, but at a lower price. Policy Genius has saved customers an average of $1,250 a year over what they were paying for home and auto insurance before. Whether you're setting up a new policy or switching your old one, their team will handle all the paperwork. Getting started is easy. Just visit policygenius.com, answer a few quick questions about yourself and your property, and they will do the rest. They'll compare rates from America's top insurers, from Progressive to Allstate, and find your lowest quotes. I saved a ton of money. The Policy Genius team can look for ways to save you more, including bundling your home and auto policies, which they did for me. And if they find a better rate than what you're paying now, they'll switch you over for free. Their top-notch services earn Policy Genius thousands of five-star reviews across Trustpilot and Google. So head to policygenius.com to get started now. Policy Genius. When it comes to insurance, it's nice to get it right. Everybody, welcome back. We have a few cleanup stories to share from this past week. First, Andrew, I'd like to talk a little bit about the Sussman indictment.
As you know, as everyone knows, a few weeks back, the beleaguered and illegally appointed special counsel John Durham issued a crap indictment in his 2+ year investigation into the oranges of Trump Russia against a Perkins Coie lawyer named Michael Sussman.
Yeah, and by crap indictment, you mean mealy-mouthed 18 U.S.C. 1001 charge that alleged that Sussman told James Baker of the FBI that he wasn't there on behalf of any client when he handed over information on a forthcoming press report about suspicious communications between a server in Trump Tower and Alpha Bank, right? In the indictment, Durham said that Sussman materially lied to James Baker when he told him that he wasn't there on behalf of a client. And that struck us as so fishy that we went and got a former prosecutor, Randall Eliason, to come on the show and confirm that this was indeed hot garbage.
Yeah, and I know you and I have gone over this indictment in our respective shows, and when we talked to Randall Eliason, we really took a deep dive. But specifically, talking to him, I got stuck on materiality, mm-hmm. which is an element of any 1001 charge, right? Specifically, in the indictment, Durham claims that the lie was material because had Sussman simply said he was there on behalf of a client, whether it's cybersecurity guy number one or campaign number one, which was obviously the Clinton campaign, if he had said that, James Baker and the entirety of the FBI in that investigation might have done things differently. And it was the word might that caught my attention, because what Durham failed to explain was how that information might have changed the way the FBI looked at the data.
Yeah. And once again, you're exceptionally prescient here, because Sussman's lawyers have now filed a court document called a motion for a bill of particulars. And you know I love obscure procedural stuff, right? And this is Federal Rule of Criminal Procedure 7F, which says that if an indictment doesn't give a criminal defendant specific knowledge of the elements of the crime or crimes with which they've been charged, you, as the lawyer for that criminal defendant, can file a motion to make the government tell you exactly what the crime is and exactly what the elements are so that, you know, you can defend yourself on those specific elements of the crime. Yeah, that's that for which the government bears the burden of proof, right? And that leads to your point, AG, which here, I'm going to read to you from page 14. This is Sussman's lawyers, but this might as well be Alison Gill. Quote, the indictment alleges further that had Mr. Sussman disclosed that he was representing specific clients, it might have prompted the FBI general counsel to ask for the identity of such clients, which in turn might have prompted further questions, and that the FBI might have taken additional or more incremental steps before opening and or closing an investigation, and might have allocated its resources differently or more efficiently and uncovered more complete information about the reliability and provenance of the purported data at issue.
Yes, and I'd like to note that they put in this filing of a bill of particulars, emphases added, because every single time the word might appeared, it was italicized. So it might have prompted the FBI, might have taken additional steps, might have allocated its resources, might have. And I was like, so it appears that the Watkins Latham lawyers also had issues with the word might as it pertains to materiality. And so I was like, yay. But also at the same time, oh my God, this indictment is so terrible. another consideration you had, Andrew, was about the he said nature of the quote unquote lie.
Yeah.
And we talked about this with Eliason. And let me read to you, because this is so good, we might as well have written this, you and I, Andrew. They say, at bottom, the special counsel has brought a false statement charge on the basis of a purported oral statement made over 5 years ago for which there is only a single witness, Mr. Baker, for which there is no recording and for which there are no contemporaneous notes by anyone who was actually in the meeting. Not only that, but the special counsel has brought this false statement charge even though Sussman had consistently maintained, including in testimony under oath, that he met with Mr. Baker on behalf of a cyber expert client. And even though Mr. Baker has testified under oath in ways that corroborate rather than undermine Sussman's account, for example, Baker testified that he did not remember Sussman specifically saying whether he was meeting on behalf of a client, and that what he did remember is that Sussman met with him because cyber experts had come across suspicious information and they wanted to brought to the FBI. Now, unpack that, Andrew, because
yeah,
it's
no,
like
that,
guy
that
alone,
was...
no notes, no recording 5 years ago, and he testified under oath that what you allege in this indictment is fucking bullshit.
Yeah, and that was the point that you made to Randall, to me. The comparisons that are being made, right? Again, 18 U.S.C. 1001, false statement in a government investigation, are to, right, Michael Flynn, George Papadopoulos. But remember, in all of those cases, we knew what the false statement was, right? That is kind of, you know, it's like, when you sue someone for defamation, right, you identify the false things they said about you. If you sue someone for defamation and you say, well, you know, like they came in and they were really shady about X, Y, right? Like that's not defamation, right? And similarly in the criminal case, like that's not 18 U.S.C. 1001 unless you can identify what the false statement is. So what the court is going to have to do here is decide whether to grant the request for a bill of particulars. I think they will. And if they do, that will require the government to produce to the defense more information not presently given in the charging documents. And again, we pointed this. I think Randall Eliason was especially good on this point that, you know, it's a 27-page indictment that was 26 and a half pages of rhetoric and, you know, sort of omitted kind of the key things that you would need, you know, in a typical indictment, right? So, among other things, what the defense is asking for is the exact words of Sussman's alleged false statement. They have to get that. Which crime the special counsel believes Sussman has committed. And
right, because they sort of, in the indictment, they were like, they sort of said he didn't say something, but then said he did say something materially false. So is that 1001 or 1001A2, right? Like,
right,
you don't even
yeah.
tell us what effing crime you're accusing him here of. They don't even spell it out. They don't give the code and the thing, do they?
No, they don't. And then, as you correctly point out, to the extent that the allegation is a material omission, right, because omissions are different than false statements, under 1001A1, then they're entitled to know, A, the specific information that Sussman failed to disclose, B, to whom, C, what legal duty required Mr. Sussman to disclose such information, and D, why the information was material. So it all comes back to that word that so caught your attention and exactly rightly so.
Yeah, and what legal duty requires you, right? Because
yeah.
you and I had talked to Eliason about, like, look, if I'm doing a podcast or if I'm appearing on a show and I say I am here on behalf of the Department of Veterans Affairs, but if I don't have a legal duty to say that I am. You know, I might have a VA really wishes I did duty, but I just thought that was really interesting.
Yeah.
Now, all this is a bill of particulars being filed without prejudice to any other pretrial motions Sussman may bring on the matter. And that stuck out to me because they said it every single paragraph they could. They said, oh, and further, without prejudice to any other pretrial motions. Would that include a pretrial motion to just dismiss the entire case completely, either after they got all the information that they need and said, okay, well, here's why we should dismiss it, or just dismiss it on the grounds that John Durham was not appointed under any known authority, given special counsel regulations, 28 U.S. Code section, I think 600.3A, in which states special counsel shall be chosen from outside the government. I mean, are these the other pretrial without prejudice to pretrial motions? Is that kind of what they're saying?
Yes. And so all of this this is the kind of procedural geekery that I love, that, you know, it is. You set me up perfectly. So this is really about timing, right? So this is a motion for a bill of particulars under Federal Rule Criminal Procedure 7F. Under 7F, you have the absolute right to request a bill of particulars within 14 days of the indictment being handed down, right? If it's outside 14 days, you have what you do is you seek leave of court. And in the court's discretion, they can decide, oh, in the interest of justice, we're either going to permit or deny you to file your bill of particulars. So as good practice, when you see an indictment like this, that is, despite being 27 pages long, unbelievably short on the facts that you need to know whether to defend your client or not, you want to file your motion for a bill of particulars to understand this right away within those first 2 weeks. Hmm. Now, so clock starts ticking. You got to get it in before 14 days. Otherwise, the court could just say, yeah, you know, this is a meritorious motion, but too late. You know, you should have been in the first 2 weeks. In terms of your question, right, arguing an argument that I am positive Sussman's lawyers will make, right? That is the ultra virus claim that we discussed that said John Durham, not appointed under any known authority and not properly a special counsel with authority to bring this case, that would probably fall within Federal Rule 12b2 of the Rules of Criminal Procedure, which allows a defendant to object that the court lacks jurisdiction at any time. Right? So you can bring that motion whenever you want. There are also a bunch of other dispositive motions, right, that fall under 12b3 that can be raised at any time before trial, right? Those are things arguing that the indictment lacks specificity, right, which you could see being kind of the next step. If you get a bill of particulars and, right, Sussman's team still says, yeah, well, you know, we think you were, like, shady with Jim Baker, right? Like, yeah, you would then move to dismiss the indictment for lack of specificity. You could move, this is an analog to the 12b6 civil motion, right? You can move that it fails to state a federal crime, right? For some other defect in the indictment, right? All of those fall under criminal rule 12b3. Yeah. And you can bring them at any time before trial.
So this is a timing thing. They have 14 days to get that bill of particulars out, and they say without prejudice to any other pretrial motions, because there will be. And then whenever they want, tomorrow if they want, they could file a motion to dismiss based on, you know, the fact that he has no standing or jurisdiction because he wasn't appointed under any authority as special counsel. Or like you said, they can then, or maybe they wait until they get back a response to the bill of particulars and then review it and then file motions to dismiss based on the bullshit that Durham will inevitably hand them. In his reply. So yeah, I think that makes more sense to me that it's a timing thing, and so I'm glad you pointed that out, because I was like, man, they really want me to know that this is without prejudice to future motions, like pretrial motions.
And again, particularly defendants, right? And particularly criminal defendants, we want you to be able to argue in the alternative. And you know, that's what they're doing. They're preserving their right to do that.
Yeah, and I didn't see a leave of court request, but I thought it was 3 weeks. I thought there were more than 14 days between the indictment and the bill of particulars, unless they didn't receive the indictment until after it was filed with Pacer.
Because you and I
talked about the indictment 3 weeks ago.
But the 14 days runs from service. So I presume... on the same basis that you said, right, which is because we are seeing this now, I presume that it is within 14 days of when they were served.
Though I imagine even if it weren't and they did ask for leave of court, which it just means permission, right? I'm pretty sure they would have gotten it. This is a pretty high profile case, and I don't think any judge would be like, nope, I'm going to risk it. And you know, I don't want to hear your really obviously good arguments for a bill of particulars, because I really just want you to win on appeal. And as much as it would be cool to play tricks like that as a judge, it's they don't.
No. And you raise, you know, whether left or right, regardless of sort of the merits of the opinion, the primary determinant, if you are a U.S. District Court judge, is my opinion going to get slapped down on appeal? Right. And nobody wants that. So, I think that is 100% correct.
Yeah, and if they could come back and say, we filed a bill of particulars and asked for a leave of court, and you didn't grant it, and that's why we are where we are.
Yep, yep.
And
that's
yeah,
an easy reversal. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Yep, yep. All right, well, that was fun. That was much better news than the A block. I mean, the whole thing is an exercise in a waste of taxpayer money. It's a political... I'm actually disappointed in John Durham, who has a history of going after mafia, mob bosses, and bullshit, that he would participate in that kind of language. And I have to question why. That kind of 26 of 27 pages being nothing but a political ad campaign is really disappointing for me. I'm not friend. John Durham's not my dad or anything, but I'm disappointed.
I share that. I will go back to, you know, I came on your show to say why I thought the appointment of Bill Barr was going to be a good thing. So, you know, there's
John
plenty.
Durham or Bill Barr.
Oh, yeah. No, I was going back.
Oh, yeah,
to,
yeah.
To, I'm saying
you're all the way back.
There's plenty of disappointment in otherwise, you know, institutional figures to go around that I just can't figure out. So,
yeah, true. All right, everybody, we have comings and goings next, and we got some pretty interesting, a new twist to comings and goings. So stick around. We'll be right back. Hello, everyone. It's Allison Gill, and this portion of Clean Up on Aisle 45 is brought to you by Feels CBD, F-E-A-L-S. I love it. It gives me the feels. CBD isn't about what you feel, though. It's about what you don't feel, like stress, anxiety, and pain. I definitely recommend Feels CBD. It is safe, it's organic, and it's helped me sleep better. It's reduced my anxiety. It's lessened soreness and pain after workouts or after sleeping. And keeping a clear head and feeling great is easy with Feels. There's no hangovers or addictions. I feel calmer. My muscles are less sore. My mood is lifted. I can fall asleep more easily at night. Put a few drops of Feels under your tongue and you can feel the difference within minutes. Deliveries are hassle-free and is delivered directly to your door without a prescription needed. And they have this amazing CBD hotline, which is free. And they can assist you in finding the exact right CBD dose for you. It's amazing. The Feels monthly membership makes self-care simple. You'll save money on every order, and you can pause or cancel at any time. It's a very, very friendly user interface, too. Start feeling better with Feels. Become a member today by going to feels.com/cleanup, and you'll get 50% off your first order with free shipping included. That's Feels, feals.com/cleanup to become a member and get 50% automatically taken off your first order with free shipping. Feels.com/cleanup. It's good to feel good. Everybody, welcome back. Before we get to comings and goings, I have a couple quick cleanups for you. The Biden administration is moving to relax the rules for the federal student loan forgiveness program. And this could offer debt relief to thousands of teachers, social workers, military members, people who work for the federal government, public servants. And Congress created this program as a reward for college students who go into public service. As long as they made 10 years of payments on their federal student loans, the program erased the remainder.
Yeah, so great program. But the problem is that more than 90% of applicants have been rejected, right? After making more than a decade of payments, right? That's the precondition. Many borrowers have found that they have the wrong type of federal loan or a repayment plan that they thought would be eligible but isn't under the program. So thousands have been stuck with debt that they thought would be clear.
Yeah, me included, right?
Oh.
Before Biden stepped in and discharged my entire student loan, I was battling with the PSLF, the Public Student Loan Forgiveness, for over 5 years, half of my fucking career in federal service, trying to get payments that I made to count toward that program, right? And just before my student loans were discharged, they're like, yeah, we reviewed everything. Congratulations, these count. And then Biden was like, ah, fuck it, I'm erasing the whole thing because of my disability veteran status. Which was a new rule for him. He's chipping away at student debt. But now, through October 2022, borrowers who have worked 10 years in a qualifying job will be eligible for loan relief no matter what kind of federal loan repayment plan they have. Past loan payments that were previously ineligible will now count, moving tens of thousands of borrowers. I think 550,000 borrowers closer to the finish line, actually.
Wow. Yeah. And again, like we say, this matters, right? I would love to see comprehensive action on federal student loans. I think it's hard to argue that this is not what a sensible adult grown-up government would do, right? Would look at a program that is intended to help. Yeah, go ahead.
Sorry. And Andrew, this matters not just to the borrowers, but to the people in their lives. For example, because my student loan was forgiven, I have an extra at least $1,000 in income every month, which means I can hire more people, pay more people, and I pay taxes on that money now. I didn't before when I was making student loan payments. So I help the tax coffers. I help the deficit. I help jobs because of these simple moves. It's not, you know, I just want to kind of make it clear that it doesn't just help that one individual. So when people are like, I had to pay my debt, why should you not have to pay yours? It doesn't help me at all. It does fucking help you, Jeb. So, yeah. Like, shush. Sorry, I get mad.
I love that. No. I am glad. Rant away. In other cleanup news, Biden on Friday restored two sprawling national monuments in Utah, reversing a decision by the last guy that opened those national monuments up for mining and other developments for hundreds of thousands of acres in lands that are held sacred by Native Americans and home to archaeologically significant ancient cliff dwellings and petroglyphs. You know, the kinds of things that people ought to be interested in. This is the Bears Ears and Grand Staircase Escalante monuments in southern Utah. They encompass more than 3.2 million acres of land. That is roughly the size of the state of Connecticut. They were created by Democratic administrations under a century-old law that allows presidents to protect sites considered historic, geographically, or culturally significant. And that's what they are.
Yeah, and then in comes Donald, who wants to strip mine Jupiter Hollow. I keep thinking of big business. Or you know, when they tried to put oil rigs on the school grounds during Saved by the Bell, and poor Becky the Duck was coated in oil. Like, what? And that is just an evil Lex Luthor villain thing to fucking do, you know? but in a separate action, he restored protections, Biden did, at a marine conservation area off New England, off the coast, that has been used for commercial fishing under an order by Donald. A rules change approved by Donald allowed for commercial fishing at the Northeast Canyons and Seamounts National Monument in the Atlantic Ocean, nearly 5,000 square miles southeast of Cape Cod. And the fishermen are mad, but I don't care.
And a little bit of news. Deb Haaland, the first Native American to serve as a cabinet secretary, said that Biden's action was not just about the national monuments, right? Quote, it's about this administration centering the voices of indigenous people and affirming the shared stewardship of this landscape with tribal nations. The president's action today writes a new chapter that embraces indigenous knowledge, ensures tribal leadership has a seat at the table, and demonstrates that by working together, we can build a brighter future for all of us. I love those words. She's exactly right, right? Like that. This is a question about increasing the diversity of voices. It's not about, you know, always ruling on that, right? Like I'm skeptical of claims that, you know, things are sacred, right? But it is about hearing from the individuals who lived on that land for thousands of years, rather than just, you know, sort of presuming their intent one way or the other, right? And I love that in a way, I mean, this has been a continuing theme of ours in comings and goings, that the Biden administration has been way more progressive in terms of diversity, in terms of diversity of voices, than I anticipated, frankly.
Yeah, and you know, we are recording this Monday, October 11th, which we'll just call the holiday formerly known as Columbus Day, because the White House has declared that it is Indigenous Peoples Day, first White House in history to do so. And, you know, I mean, which is great. I've been, for 12 years, I've been saying, why the hell do we have a Columbus Day? I think my joke was, how do you even celebrate Columbus Day? What, do you walk to the wrong house and murder everybody there? so it made no sense to me because he was lost and he was an asshole. And then I think I go on to say, I got lost one time. I don't get a day. So this is, you know, all joking aside, just an incredible set of events to save Bears Ears and Grand Staircase on what is now declared Indigenous Peoples Day.
Yep. I love it.
Okay, Andrew, now for the thing, the twist, mm-hmm. right? Usually we talk about who's coming and who's going, but this is about moving rocks out of the way, okay? Because U.S. Circuit Judges Jose Cabranes and Rosemary Pooler, two Democratic appointees of different ideological leanings, by the way, one's more conservative, have told the White House they plan to take senior status. They were arguing at first, like, you do it. They're both going to take senior status, which could shift and probably will shift the orientation of the court and giving Joe Biden another opportunity to reshape the bench. Can you tell us which court this is and why this is so awesome and what senior status is, please? Can you enlighten us?
Yeah, let me unpack all of that. Let's start off with senior status. Senior status comes from 28 U.S.C. Section 371, which allows the title of that section is Retirement on Salary, Retirement in Senior Status. So basically, it's a kind of semi-retirement, right? Federal judges are appointed and constitutionally they serve for life. But that that cannot be eliminated by an act of Congress, right? So there's nothing we can do short of impeachment to remove the unqualified losers that Donald Trump elevated to the federal bench. But the terms of that, like exactly how they're serving, can indeed be adjusted by Congress. And so Congress passed a law that said, if you're over 65 and you have 15 years on the bench, then you can elect senior status. And basically, that turns you into kind of a roving judge at large, right? And you can be assigned to that court and also to any court that is inferior to that court, right? So Jose Cabranes is 81. Rosemary Pooler is 83. So one might say they have a well-deserved semi-retirement coming to them. You know, they're both in their 80s. This is the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, which was reshaped by Donald, you know, as with the entirety of the federal judiciary. This will open up two full-time judicial spots for new judges on the Second Circuit Court of Appeals that governs New York, New England, right? Will still allow both of those judges to be assigned to cases on a reduced workload. So pretty sensible system.
I have a question for you. Did I hear you say that the senior status rules are subject to congressional change? Is that something Congress has to approve? Damn it. Okay. Because I was going to say otherwise. What a fantastic opportunity to lower the age and requirements on senior status and expand the federal bench by offering a bunch of more people qualified to take senior status so that you have more seats to fill and more judges on the federal bench. Now, I mean, granted, the spots of active judges still remains the same, but then you got all sorts of cool Democrats in there, or Democrat appointed, Biden appointed judges, and everyone else is just sort of roving. I don't know. It was just a thought, but I guess
could we take some of these Trump imbeciles, create a special class of judges that gets paid 10 times their base salary, right? And basically bribe them off the court. Like, we could do that, right? Like,
that's what I was thinking.
We're joking about it, but like, that's a thing that we could do if we elect more Democrats. It's not a likely thing, you know, we are not powerless to reshape the federal judiciary, to double the amount of federal judges, as you and I have been calling for forever, you know, to pack the Supreme Court, and all of it is contingent on electing more Democrats in 2022. So
To Congress, to Congress, yep. Because they're the ones who would have to do that.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, knowing that we've got two vacancies now, that's cool. Now, moving on to, we've had some appointments that we got to this week, and I believe you have that list of appointments if you just want to go through that.
Yeah, that's right, Allison. So today, President Biden announced his intent to nominate the following individuals. These are a lot of inspector general potential nominees. And again, this is the public announcement. They have not formally been submitted to the Senate. All of these require the advice and consent of the Senate. These are important roles. But again, folks that about which, you know, quite candidly, I don't know that much. So it's important for us to show that, you know, we're aware Biden is still doing his job. So Cummings, a big welcome to James O'Brien, the nominee for coordinator for sanctions policy with the rank of ambassador at Department of State. To Michael Kubayanda, who is the nominee for commissioner of the Postal Regulatory Commission. To Elizabeth De Leon Bargava, who is the nominee for assistant secretary for administration at the Department of Housing and Urban Development. To Parisa Salehi, the nominee for Inspector General at the Export-Import Bank of the United States. Brian Tomney, Inspector General at the Federal Housing Finance Agency. Ben Wagner, Inspector General at the Tennessee Valley Authority. And John Putnam, General Counsel at the Department of Transportation. So these are critical. General Counsel's typically third in line. These are crucial positions that were unfilled at these cabinet level agencies, and they are now fast tracked to be filled. So welcome aboard to those seven folks.
Yeah, especially with the Department of Transportation General Counsel, with the forthcoming infrastructure bills, is going to be a hugely important position.
Yeah, absolutely. And Putnam, you know, was a transportation, environment, energy attorney in Denver, Colorado, and in Washington, D.C. So, you know, he's got a long history of being involved in transportation. I don't know much about him beyond that, but again, significant kind of roll up your sleeves position, and it's good for us to see bodies filling those seats.
Agreed. So welcome. Welcome to all.
Welcome aboard.
How many? Well, I'm assuming we still have quite a few seats to fill.
We did get, by the way,
this week, and I don't know if we covered this last week or not. I apologize if I can't remember, but we got new U.S. attorneys in the Eastern District of New York and the Southern District of New York, the Sovereign District of New York. I do think we covered it. I put out a tweet saying good morning to everyone except Donald, Ivanka Jr. and Eric. I just want to introduce you to the new U.S. attorney at the Southern District of New York, which is a very crucial and critical position considering all of those redacted Appendix D Mueller report handoffs. I'm certain some of them went to the Southern District. We had that case closed against individual one in the Southern District without prejudice. We've got Rudy going on in the Southern District. We've got Ukraine going on in the Eastern District. I mean, these are two really big appointments. So I'm interested to see. Now, we've had some good acting folks in those positions before. I don't want to be like, it was Barr until yesterday. That's not the case. All right, that's it. That's the show. Thanks again to all our patrons who support this, make it possible. Andrew, thanks for joining us from the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. I hope you enjoy the rest of your vacation. And again, a happy birthday to you. I know that you celebrated while a sea. So I just wanted to extend that. And anybody who wants to send their birthday wishes into Andrew, you can just post up on Patreon. That's patreon.com/aisle45pod, AISLE45POD. And we'll see everybody next week. Any final thoughts, Andrew?
No, just so happy to be back doing the show. And I missed the past couple weeks. And thank you for the kind birthday wishes.
You're welcome. You're older than me, so it's always a pleasure.
Oh, is that where we're going? All right.
I don't know if that's actually true.
Throw down offline. I'm 29, all right. So I don't know.
Oh, I win. No. All right, everybody. We'll see you next week on Clean Up on Aisle 45.
Until then.
Clean Up on Aisle 45 is written, researched, and produced by Allison Gill and Andrew Torres, with editing by Molly Hockey. Our art and logo designer by Joelle Reeder and Moxie Design Studios, and our music is composed and performed by Adam Orr. Clean Up on Aisle 45 is a proud member of the MSW Media Network, a collection of creator-owned podcasts dedicated to news, politics, and justice. For more information, visit mswmedia.com.
They might be giants have been on the road for too long.
Too long.
And they might be giants aren't even sorry.
Not even sorry.
And audiences like the shows too much.
Too much.
And now they might be giants are playing their breakthrough album, Flood.
All of it.
And they still have time for other songs.
They're fooling around.
Who can stop They Might Be Giants and their liberal rock agenda?
Who?
No one.
This ad was paid for with somebody else's money.
Hi, this is John Cryer, and I am hosting a new 7-part true crime podcast called Lawyers, Guns, and Money that'll challenge everything you think you know about U.S. covert operations and presidential misconduct. From Jack Bryan, the director of American PSYOP, comes the incredible true story of John Mattis, a newly sworn-in Miami public defender in the 1980s who has found himself completely in over his head.
I step off the plane, and there is a van with a couple guys with Uzis. And one of them in broken English said, "Welcome to Bogota, John."
Mattis's first felony defendant has been arrested for having a machine gun and tells Mattis a dangerous secret.
He was shipping arms into Central America on behalf of the CIA. As a first-time lawyer, I want to act like I know what I'm doing.
But with the help of a Colombian drug smuggler...
How much money the CIA raised by hitting up drug dealers?
A lot of money, millions of dollars.
An Alabama mercenary.
They were prepared to die to the last man. I saw this in them. I saw the fire in their eyes. And they made me their war chief.
And a newly elected senator, John Kerry.
We are looking at allegations of drug running, gun smuggling, conspiracy to commit murder and murder itself.
He'll fight to free his client.
The judge said, "Show me, in a courtroom, how we were at war."
Expose an illegal war being run by the White House.
I mean, I wanted them involved, but I didn't want to be on record as doing it.
And somehow stay alive in the process.
I just escaped a kidnapping by the CIA in Costa Rica.
This is Lawyers, Guns, and Money.
So you have a man in an Armani suit standing in the bow of a boat with a rocket launcher and says, "If I lose sight of you, I will launch. You will be vaporized."
Available everywhere starting October 29th, or get it ad-free and early starting October 22nd at lawyersgunsandmoney.supercast.com. There you'll find bonus episodes along with exclusive content. Subscribe now.